On Christmas night in 1776, General George Washington led 2,400 soldiers of the Continental Army across the Delaware River, north of Philadelphia. They planned to attack a garrison of Hessian soldiers in the employ of the British Crown, encamped in Trenton, New Jersey. The ultimate success of Washington's crossing revitalized the rebellious American cause and dimmed British enthusiasm for quelling the revolution. Historian David Hackett Fisher of Brandeis University recently completed work on the story of Washington's fabled attack. His book, Washington's Crossing, will be published in February. David Hackett Fisher joined us at the site where Washington assembled his troops for our own crossing of the Delaware. Standing in a heavy rain, Professor Fisher described the military circumstances that brought Washington and his men to eastern Pennsylvania.
It was a desperate moment for Washington and the army, the Revolution. They'd suffered heavy defeats in a long campaign around New York. For 6 months, they'd been fighting the largest army that had been brought to America, more than 30,000 British and German troops. And the Americans had lost one battle after another. And George Washington was forced to retreat across the Hudson River. And as he went, his army shrank. And as they were marching through Newark, a young officer who was Lieutenant James Monroe stood by the side of the road and counted the troops. And their numbers had shrunk from about 30,000 as well down to 3,000 men. 90% of the American army had been lost. As they retreated across New Jersey, there was a sense of real desperation about what they called the cause. They thought the cause was lost. And George Washington himself wrote a letter home to Mount Vernon, urging his family to prepare to move into the mountains.
The British had been quick to exploit the Continental Army's troubles. In New Jersey, British officials offered amnesty to any citizen who pledged allegiance to the empire. In the fall of 1776, more than 3,000 people in New Jersey gave their oath to the crown. Even Richard Stockton, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, allied himself with King George III. In tightening their grip on New Jersey, the British had help from thousands of Hessian professional soldiers.
They were rented to Britain by their prince, the Landgraf of Hesse. But they were fighting for a sense of honor and service. They had a cause, which they cast in those terms, which was as urgent to them as was the cause of liberty to the Americans. There's a myth that attaches to this event that they were incompetent, mercenary, drunk on Christmas Day. None of that is true. What makes Washington's achievement here all the more remarkable is that he was up against the first team. He was, and these were very skillful, able opponents.
The Hessians and the British foraged in the New Jersey countryside. Foraging led to plundering, which soon turned into pillaging. Soldiers invaded homes and stripped residents of their possessions. There were many reports of rape by British troops.
The people of New Jersey began to turn against their conquerors, and they began to rise. There was a spontaneous rising up and down the river here. Small groups of men and women in New Jersey taking up arms, fighting, keeping the Hessians and the British away from their farms. As they did so, they drew the garrisons that had been placed along the river farther and farther apart, so they were unable to support each other. And Washington thought he saw an opportunity there, and he was quick to make the most of it.
A garrison of 1,500 Hessians was based in Trenton.
A very elaborate plan was made to concentrate this very small American army against that one garrison at Trenton. It was a scheme with many parts. Once they thought to do this, they thought to throw all of their resources across the river, and it was a big plan. It had four parts. There were to be four columns that were to cross the river at the same time and to swoop down on the Hessians in a synchronized attack. Then things began to go wrong.
The weather was awful. Winter temperatures came early to the Delaware Valley that December. It warmed, though, as Christmas neared, breaking up the surface of the frozen Delaware into fast-moving ice floes. Then conditions got worse.
A nor'easter came sweeping into the Delaware Valley, and as they were preparing to cross, a storm struck with great violence. And it was a combination of snow. We have one account that speaks of snow and hail and rain, and he forgot to mention sleet, which was driving into the faces of these men with a northeastern wind as they were preparing to cross the river.
Many of Washington's troops crowded into flat-bottomed Durham boats, typically used to carry cargo along the river. Horses and artillery crossed on ferries. They had no choice but to put up with the weather. In preparation for our crossing, we took refuge from the rain in a boathouse at Pennsylvania's Washington Crossing Historic Park. For Washington's men, the swift, ice-choked river posed a great risk.
Most of the men in Washington's army could not swim. Most people in the 18th century could not swim, much to the fury of Benjamin Franklin, who was a great swimmer and tried in vain to persuade Americans to take to the water. And as they were crossing, some of the men went overboard. One of them was Colonel John Hazlitt from Delaware, who went into this icy river and was hauled out just in the nick of time. His legs were severely swollen, and yet he marched and fought and never complained.
Washington and his soldiers needed more than 4 hours to cross the Delaware aboard their Durham boats and ferries. We covered the distance in about 40 seconds in a Toyota. Ice jams at the Trenton Falls and along the banks of the Delaware prevented 3 of the 4 planned crossings, but Washington didn't know that. At New Jersey's Washington Crossing State Park, as the rain subsided and temperatures warmed, Professor Fisher took us to where Washington and his troops gathered after the crossing.
He came ashore and sat down on an old beehive, a wooden box, which had been a beehive, and gathered his cloak around him and wondered if he should call the whole thing off. As his men came ashore, they were desperately cold and wet. They'd been moving into the face of a nor'easter. The first thing they did was to find the fence rails and build themselves a fire and gathered round. And as they did, Washington sat reflecting on the ruins of his plan, as they had taken so much longer to get across the river. They would be still getting themselves together here till 4 o'clock in the morning, which meant that by the time they reached Trenton, it would be daylight and a surprise would be lost. But Washington decided that it would be even more dangerous to call it off and try to get back across the river than to go forward. And the extraordinary thing was to also see how each of these problems that rose in his path increased their determination to push ahead. And that's what they did.
Washington and his men, in a column of wagons, horses, and artillery, marched inland to the Bear Tavern Road and then turned south toward Trenton. But a deep ravine cut by Jacob's Creek slowed the army.
And they had to go down into that ravine and then back up again the other side and then repeat it once more for a tributary of the creek. And it meant they had to unharness the horses from the guns, work them down and back up again using their long drag ropes. And it was extremely difficult and very time-consuming. Washington himself almost lost control of his animal, his horse, as he was crossing the creek. And we have one account by a soldier who watched him as the horse's hind legs went out from under the horse, and Washington suddenly reached down and hooked his hands into the mane of the horse and with his brute strength pulled up the neck of the horse, threw his balance back on his hind legs, and the horse was able to get his footing again. And the soldiers who watched this were in awe of this extraordinary rider as well as general. He was described as one of the best horsemen of the age.
Once across the creek, Washington and his men were surprised to meet up with friendly forces. A regiment of Continentals had preceded them to New Jersey on a revenge mission led by Washington's rival and fellow Virginian, Adam Stephen.
He had lost a man in a boat on the river, killed by the Hessians. He came from the southern backcountry, and he had a sense of the lex talionis, the law of retaliation. So he sent his men across to kill a Hessian because they had done that to him. And these men attacked the garrison at Trenton on a Christmas night. Then were driven off and were moving back up the road and ran into Washington. Washington was shocked. He thought they had ruined his plan, that they had alerted the garrison, but decided yet again that he would push on. And the irony of it was that the Hessians, who had known that Washington was coming, thought that that first attack was the attack. And so they let down their guard just a little bit.
But enough. The Continental Army marched on toward Trenton. The Hessians saw the first flashes of American muskets from across open fields.
The Americans on the other side saw the Hessians come pouring out of their outposts. And they could hear the Hessian kettle drums beating the alarm. And to Washington's complete surprise, they had, in fact, surprised the Hessians. They'd gotten tactical surprise because of the storm, because of the attack before, because of a series of contingencies that nobody had planned or quite anticipated.
The Hessian commander, Colonel Johann Rall, organized three counterattacks against the Americans. But the Continentals' artillery held the heights outside Trenton, and American infantrymen took cover inside houses in the town as they fired on the Hessians. Losses in the two-hour battle were lopsided. The Americans captured almost 900 Hessians, more than half of the total force at Trenton. Washington had seized the initiative, but his problems weren't over.
His men in Trenton found a very large supply of rum and consumed a good part of it before Washington could intervene. And it was decided, for a number of reasons, not least was the condition of the army, that it might be well if they retreated back across the river again, which they did. They took their prisoners with them, and the crossing was more difficult going back again than it had been coming out.
Rum may have warmed Washington's troops for the moment, but they faced almost five more years of fighting before the British finally conceded defeat and left the colonies to their independence. That independence, Professor Fisher says, was defined by the performance of the soldiers who fought under George Washington and by their successors.
Every generation in America goes to war. We've had a major war in just about every generation since 1630. How we go about that says much about who we are and what we do. And what these men did was to set an example.
David Hackett Fisher is a professor of history at Brandeis University. He's the author of Washington's Crossing, published by Oxford University Press. Professor Fisher, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Our feature on Washington's Crossing was recorded by Chris Sakis and produced by Neil Carruth. To learn more about the event, please visit our website at npr.org.